you guys are looking at the story of Esther. And today I just want to jump straight into the middle of the story. I want to jump straight into chapter 4. So where Esther's in her bedroom with this massive do or die decision to make. So you guys reenacted the story 2 weeks ago, is that right? How did that go? Good acting skills? Yeah. Oh, very good. Okay. So you already know that Esther is the queen of Persia, this massive empire that stretches from Sudan. Ah, we have our Esther here. So this massive empire that stretches from Africa to India. And you already know that she has the secret identity as a Jew. And in the many twists and turns of this story, we have this villain, Haman. who has this long history of his people, the Amalekites, this whole Jew-hating thing. So they've got this whole kind of, I don't know, like Holland and Germany or Australia and New Zealand, but really deep. So this really kind of long-seated history of really kind of, I wouldn't say we hate the Australians, but a real national identity of being anti-Jewish. So he's come up with this plan to get rid of the Jews. And he's gotten the king to agree in the 12th month that there's going to be this certain day and they're going to be wiped out. So Esther's just learned of this plan in chapter 4, and Mordecai says to her, she is their only hope, and she must risk her life to approach the king and his court to beg for their lives. So let's read verse 10. So chapter 4, verse 10. So then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a message from Mordecai, saying, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court, without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come to the king for 30 days. When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. Who knows, perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. So now we have Esther in her bedroom, and she's just like out of her mind. She's pacing up and down, and I want to just freeze that one scene, okay? And I want to step back from that and look at that from a few different angles today, and for us to just unpack what's going on here and what it might be that God has to say to us in this particular scene. So this story of Esther is the story of the Jewish people, right? So we have them few different kind of dates, but roughly 500 BC, so post-Babylonian exile. And it's a pretty bleak story where we pick it up, right? So for hundreds of years, God has pretty much seemed to kind of abandon them. They're anything but the powerful small nation of the past whose God came through for them with great feats. So think of the stories that they would have heard as young children growing up. You know, they would have heard those stories of this amazing escape from Egypt. So the Red Sea parting, these battles where against all odds, God came through for them. So the David and Goliath type stories, all the little Jewish kids would have grown up knowing these stories off by heart. But now, nothing. No protection, no miraculous rescue, just exile and radio silence for a few hundred years. So then the Persian Empire comes into power and it tells the exiles they can head back home if they want. So many Jews choose to go back to Jerusalem, the Holy Land, where their story as a nation has been centered and where the majority of the rest of this story will unfold, right? So Jerusalem's the New York or the London or the Tokyo of the world. It's the center of the story. But the Jews in Esther, these Jews have chosen to stay. So they're in the wings. They're not on the main stage. They're off on the side. And they've chosen a bird in the hand, so to speak, to make do where they are. So they've got jobs, they've got some way of getting food on the table and a roof over their head. And they just want to stick with what they know. They don't want to risk that for leaving, for the hope of rebuilding a homeland and a temple to a god that hasn't really been that active. So for many of the Jews in the group in this book of Esther, God hasn't acted the way that he was supposed to act, pretty much. So we have this whole story here, and for us, it's easy for us to forget that these people lived at that moment. So we pick this book up and we can read it and we can see for the Jewish people, you know, they go through all these different periods, and they've been through this period where they got pretty lazy about things like justice and compassion. And you have this God constantly telling them through the prophets, you guys need to clean up your act. You actually need to be a nation that reflects who I am as a God. You need to show justice. You need to show compassion. You need to show all of these things. And Israel constantly refuses to listen. So God lets them go their way, and they end up in exile. So we can see that because we can sit there and flick through all those different books, right? And it's easy to flick forward and see Jesus comes on the scene. So we know that in this fairly bleak book, there's this history and there's this future. There's this kind of rescue mission, right, so to speak. So we know that Jesus is coming. We know that God hasn't abandoned him, that he's thinking, he's planning something. Something's coming, right? But for the Jews in this story, at this moment of time that we're frozen, God doesn't seem to care. God seems very much absent and probably would have seemed like a fairy tale. But not all Jews. So we have some Jews in this book that are holding on to hope. We have Esther's uncle Mordecai, this man of faith, this man who remembers those great stories of this God of Israel, who holds tight to those memories, who's devout. And then we have Esther. So we have this girl, and she's caught between these two competing narratives, right? These two competing views of what the world is really like. So one is that God has abandoned them, that God cannot be relied upon, and God may not even be real. And the other is of her uncle, a story of faith and hope and a God who will never forget them. And so the scene that we have frozen of Esther, because of what Haman has done, I like quickly wrote that one in. Sorry, I can't think of Alice to add in Haman into the rest of it, but oh, there you go. So Esther's frozen in this scene, and she has these two. So does she approach the king? And she's probably going to die, right? Like, if she looks at this in the normal plain view of things, it's standard court procedure that she dies if she approaches him. So does she choose the sensible thing? Surely the best chance of survival would be to kind of throw her lot in that no one will touch her as the queen, okay? That they might wipe out the rest of the Jews, but hopefully no one will touch her. Yeah, it's iffy, but if she goes and approaches the king now, it's certain death, right? So does she choose the sensible route? And to be honest, she's an orphan, right? So she's probably got this history of God didn't preserve her parents. So she's got a history there of maybe grounds for wondering, would God stick up for her? And then she has this other story, the story of faith in the unknown and the unseen, and the hope that there is a God who has acted in the past to save their people before, and that she might just be the catalyst. Remembering the Exodus story and another Jew who just happened to come to royal position and be really pivotal in the Jews being freed, right? Do you all know what story that is for kids? You probably reenacted this one before. It's Moses. Not as exciting as Haman, because you don't get to boo when you say his name. So we've got two stories. So one of faith in the unknown, the unseen, and one of the sensible, self-protective route. And you guys have been talking about this concept of open plan living, right? So this is really her choice, right? Does she build these walls of self-preservation, the sensible choice, in response to disappointment and to the seeming absence of God? Or does she break down those walls and live with this openness to hope and faith? So that there might just be a God who cares, a God who might just be at work. So we have the story on three levels, really. So this big overarching story of the Jewish people, so the exiles who stay and the exiles who return. And then we have the story on a really personal level for Esther. And then we have it, because the Bible is never a story out there. It's always something personal that the Spirit speaks to us about. So now we have the story right here in 2016 in New Plymouth. So we have that same choice for our own stories. So we come, as the characters in this story came, with our own ideas of who God is our own expectations of how he should act, of how he might have failed to act. So we also come with expectations of who God is and what his purposes are. And as our own stories unfold, we build walls, or we keep open lives, or we mix it up as we respond. And some of those internal house plans go pretty deep, and we don't necessarily share them with even those that are closest to it, to us. Sometimes we don't even share them, well, we're not even honest with ourselves about what that looks like. Because sometimes when we admit it, they can seem a little bit blasphemous. They seem to tug at the very foundations of what we believe. And it's hard to think through what might unravel if we admit those. But those walls are there, and they're very real. And they create this foundation to our lives, and they inform this internal narrative that we speak over ourselves. And they impact on how we relate to those people around us, and they impact on how we relate to God. So for me, growing up, I had these very different ideas of what God wanted to do with my life. I was a very earnest young person. And so I went to law school because I wanted to help people, right? So I was really like, this will be a good way. People like Gandhi were lawyers. And I killed myself studying because in my head, if I did my best, then, you know, God could use me with whatever he had for me. So I just had to do my best and God would be able to use me. And I got to the end of my law degree, and it didn't really work out quite how I thought it would. So I volunteered at like community law centres and I worked in legal aid, and it's a complicated system, and it never quite felt like I was really helping my clients. And it wasn't really a great fit for my personality either. I found it incredibly stressful. And after a few years of this, Lance and I decided just to go travelling. I really had no idea what I was doing, and I was really struggling with what was next. And we moved at the start of the recession, so I thought, okay, well, maybe I could try a few other things. And all I could get was temp data entry work. So for the next year, I did data entry, and I spent this year contemplating how I'd gone from being the top of my law class to data entry day after day after day. And I was really, really angry at God. I felt like I had just wasted 10 years of my life putting so much time and energy into what I thought he wanted me to do so I could help people. And I was so angry that it just seemed like it was complete silence on his part. That he didn't even give me a sense of, okay, sure, that didn't work, but it's going to develop into this, or it's going to look like this. There was just silence, and I really, really got quite angry at God. And so I slowly built up these walls. So I lowered my expectations, and I changed my story that I told myself about who God is, and about what he wants or doesn't want in terms of being involved in the pain of this world. And I built these walls. And as I tell this story, I know so many of you sitting here will have stories so much more tragic and pain that goes so much deeper. But it also might be something like that for me, it doesn't even necessarily seem like a big deal on the outside. But it means a lot to you, and it changes stuff between you and God. And today I'm not going to try and give you some answers that will be like, oh, of course, that might make sense of everything and makes it all better. You know, I could talk about free will and moral choice being meaningless unless there are consequences. And so to be able to choose to love God or to love other people, we have to choose to not love, and then how that plays out. And that stuff's important, but it doesn't necessarily break down those walls that go pretty deep. The only thing really, when I was thinking about what to say, the only thing I can say for certain is that when I have built those walls, when I have chosen to distance myself from God and to cut myself off from hope, that these walls have taken me to some of the darkest places I've ever been. Because that's the thing about wolves, they're pretty good at shutting out the light. And while, to be honest, I still, 10 years or so later, don't understand why or how God chooses to act most of the time, why he chooses to speak sometimes and stay silent other times. He's just not the kind of God we can ever easily put in a box. But I know that this choice to build walls, which is such a seemingly intuitive choice to self-preserve, works the opposite way every single time. That those walls will slowly destroy us. That God is the source of every good thing. Hey, buddy.
Yeah, you've got a red ball. Light red ball.
That God is the source of every good thing, of life and light and hope. And that he is crazy about us. And even if I don't know exactly how that plays out and I can't make every situation make sense, I know that throwing our lot in with him is actually our only hope of moving forward. What if Esther had chosen to build a wall at this moment in her story with the evil villain Haman threatening her? What if she had acted the sensible way to self-protect herself? How different this story would have ended. So what do we take from this story, right? There's no like nice pithy 10 surefire ways to deal with disappointment in God. There's no guaranteed formula for if you do this or you act this way, God will definitely act or speak. Which, to be honest, I would love if we could. If anything, this story and story after story in the Bible is messy and it twists and it turns and you can never really quite predict what God is up to. So even Mordecai, our pin-up boy for faith, doesn't even know for sure what God is going to act. He says, who knows, perhaps you have come to your position for such a time as this. Who knows, perhaps. Like, there's no definite thing here. And Esther herself, the last thing that she's recorded as saying is, as she's about to go into the king's court, is, if I die, I die. These aren't people of rock solid, I know God is coming through for me kind of faith. These people seem a lot more real, a lot more approachable. And the thing is, it's not a story primarily about them. It's not a story primarily about their faith or their virtue or their decisions. It's a story about God. So it's a story about God at work. This whole Bible is simply the story of God at work, spanning thousands of years, forming and inviting his people to join him in that story. And in reading this book, we see that while there are ups and downs and hard times and good times, that it's a good story. That it's a story of a God who is really crazy about us, who would cross oceans to come to us. It's a story that gives us hope and a future. And this future might not look anything like what we expected it to, and it might be a way off. But the bottom line is, of this story, that there is hope. We are simply invited to live in this story with open hearts, with faith, and the character of a good God. I want to finish with a passage from a book, The Sacred Diary of Adrian Plass, Christian speaker, age 45 and 3/4. Do you want to know this book? Such a good book. Everyone should read it. It's, even if you don't like books, it's hilarious. He basically spoofs the church and then comes up with these incredibly insightful moments. Like every so often you're like, whoa. So it's this kind of fictional but not fictional account of Adrian becoming a Christian speaker. And he's asked to do this really rousing evangelistic talk for this group of non-Christians. And he turns up and there's only one non-Christian and he's really bitter and angry and like, oh, you're the preacher who's supposed to convert me. So he ends up just sharing this. Look, this is after he kind of fluffs around and tries to do the other thing for a while. Look, I could be wrong, but I think God is saying to me that there are some people, and I'm sorry if I cry, this is such a beautiful passage and I probably will cry. I think there are some people here tonight who need to forgive God. Of course, he can't actually do anything wrong to be forgiven for. But that's what's so difficult sometimes, isn't it? I mean, it's not very easy to have a real row with someone who never ends up getting anything wrong, is it? There must be some of us who want to climb up onto God's lap like small children and bash at his chest with our little fists and say, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. I asked you to help me and you didn't help. You knew what I was feeling. You knew what needed to happen and you didn't do it. You say you love me, but you don't. If you did, you would have done something, but you didn't. When my son was very small, he did exactly that once or twice. First, he'd be really angry, and then he'd wear himself out with crossness. He'd cry, all curled up on my lap. And then when he had cried the last drop of energy away, he'd just fall asleep, and I'd hold him for ages. And the important thing is, I think the important thing is, that he had to go through all that fighting and fretting to get the nasty, spiky feelings out of himself. And he did it in the safest place he knew, which was in my arms. That's where I finished today. But I want to encourage you, if there's something that kind of has come up for you and you think, yeah, maybe I need to talk to God about this, or maybe I just need to be really angry at God, or just cry. There's people who would love to pray with you. So after communion, after the song, at the back over there, there'll be people who would love to just sit with you if you just want to cry, or to talk or to pray. And I really encourage you to take advantage of that opportunity, because I think we all have these walls. We all have history. We all have expectations that in some sense God has failed us in. But he's a big God. And he's a good God. And even if we don't understand it, I think we really can have faith in that character. Thank you.